Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening. This is Bennett Pomerantz. This is Anything Goes. Yes, I'm half crazy. We know that. I wanted to make some announcements before I forget. We will not have the legal show on Monday because of Passover. And on Wednesday, we will not have a Let's Talk show. We will have an Anything Goes show on Friday. And the guest, yes, you read it here first. You heard it here first. Robin Peterman will be my guest. She was supposed to be my guest, but things happened. There was a scheduling problem. And she's coming, and she'll be here. And I know because I get email every day. Is Robin coming? Is Robin coming? Is she mad at you or anything else? She is not mad at me. She even said I could yell at her. And I'm like, no, I don't yell at my friends. Especially when her husband is Steve Zahn. I mean, you don't yell at your friends. I told this gentleman, and it's the truth. I heard him on a show with World of Inc.'s Virginia Grenier and Marcia Casper Cook, and I love those ladies. But I bought, I think the first Hidden Mickey. Don't quote me, but it's somewhere in the closet, somewhere, you know, with all the other books. And I said, God, I like this guy's style. God, I want to have this guy when I have a show on it, you know. And it's sort of like, it's not my bucket list, but I can scratch it. Not that I'm trying to be rude. I want to scratch his name off the list so that, yeah, it's like he's here. David Smith is here. Oh, my God. You know, okay. It's not a fanboy thing, but if you're a Disney fan, and I grew up on Disney movies, I just bought a copy of Johnny Shiloh, and people are like, what the heck is that? And it's like Brian Keith and Kevin Cork and Daryl Hickman, and they're like, who? You know, and I feel old, but if I say Johnny Shiloh to this gentleman, I think he'll know. David, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I am really excited, especially since you've read our first Hidden Mickey book, because that means a lot, and I think we'll have a lot more to talk about.
Well, blame Virginia on that one. She didn't insist I buy it, but I bought it because it was like, oh, yes, I have to buy this guy's book. Explain Hidden Mickey to people that don't know who it is, and you guys all have to go to Amazon tomorrow and buy it, you know.
Well, thanks for the plug, and I will say that, first of all, my background, I worked at the Magic Kingdom in California at Disneyland, and I have an extensive background of 6 years working in the park. And I also have a love of writing. I'd written, prior to Hidden Mickey, I had written two top tennis and structural books as I was a tennis pro for 35 years. My father was a top tennis coach, and so that led to that. And one day I saw the movie National Treasure. I love the concept of historical fiction within the reality of real places and real people. And one night I woke up in bed thinking, what a cool story if somebody famous had left some sort of obscure trail of clues to something significant. And so I woke up that night and I literally, and I'm not kidding, sat bolt upright in bed and I said, oh my gosh, I worked for Walt Disney. Of course, he was dead, but I worked at Disneyland. And who better to have left some very intelligent and yet you would have had to work to figure out these clues. And so that was the beginning of Hidden Mickey. I called a very good friend of mine, Nancy Temple Roderick, who I ironically had met at Disneyland back in the early 80s. We lost track of each other for a long, long time. We kind of reconnected over the internet over the years. And she was a Disney historian. So I came to her and I said, with your background of Disney history and my background of working at Disneyland and knowing all the inner secrets and underground and backstage areas, I wanted to kind of throw some ideas out there about Walt leaving some obscure clues. And that's got her very excited and got me very excited. She created the characters within Hidden Mickey 1, Adam, Beth, and Lance. I brought in all the inner working aspects. She brought in the historical and some of the really neat character development elements. And it was just an amazing book to write, ironically. We wrote the entire book without having seen each other for over 20-plus years. We wrote the book simply by sending each other emails of sections of the book that either she wrote or I edited or I wrote and she edited. And it came together like that, and it just grew. And now we have 5 in the series, and it just has been a lot of fun for people like yourself and others who are Disney fans who like to read about things they may have seen while at Disneyland and learn a little history about Walt Disney along the way.
Well, I can't wait until one day you go back and you do a Zorro or, a Guy, go back or do a past one with Guy Williams. Oh, my God, I'm dating myself now. Kevin Corcoran, Brian Keith.
Yep.
Yeah, I was a live-action baby of Disney more than the animation Disney. And more than the park Disney. So, I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine, and we were talking about this off the air. I was like, I just got a copy of Johnny Shiloh, and he said, what the heck is that? And it was one of the wonderful world of Disney, wonderful world of colors shows that I loved. And, try to explain it to some people, and they look at you like you've choked on a whatever, and what I called the other David, Smith, who worked for Disney,
archivist,
and he said to me, he says, "Yeah, I've read these books," and I said, "That's good. What do you think of them?" And he says, "They're good, but." I mean, I wish you'd do another Disney book of some of the going back to, say, the 50s and 60s with Guy Williams and use them as characters, Like, remember, if you do give me a special thanks somewhere in the book.
we'd include you as a character in some way, shape, or form. Let's put it that way.
Oh, good.
Obviously we could only write about that which we knew the most about. Although it is a very nostalgic look, as you've read the first one. We go back in time when Walt was alive and why we wanted to give some backstory as to why and where he left these clues and a little bit of the touch of Walt's ability to be the world's greatest storyteller. In fact, the scene in the old Connolly building where his first animation studio in Kansas City was, we take you back and you have to find a clue there, but we had a flashback when Walt met these hardcore gang members and he basically diffused the situation by telling them and entertaining them as only Walt Disney. So there's a lot of nostalgic, a very affectionate look at Walt Disney, while also delving into a lot of the true history of Walt, his locations, the Dreaming Tree, the Connolly Building. We also take you, of course, to the island of Trinidad and Tobago, where Walt filmed the movie Swiss Family Robinson, which I'm sure you're somewhat of a fan of, being a live-action fan of Disney. So
give me Haley Mills and I'm happy, okay?
Yeah, you betcha. You bet. I certainly
and her
can,
father, of course, being Sir John Mills, I'm dating myself now. James MacArthur. Everybody says, "Oh, from Hawaii 50," and I'm like, "Yeah," but he did, The Light at the End of the Forest with Disney and Swiss Family Robinson and Kidnapped, and they didn't worry that he was a California kid. Disney was great, but they didn't worry about an accent or anything. I mean, Guy, and we were talking about Guy Williams. I just saw, thank God, Disney, this is the Watchathon week on cable, and I just saw the 1962 or 63 Prince and the Pauper with Guy Williams and Sean Scully, and I'm like, oh, God, they don't make movies like this. And half of these things aren't on DVD. So it was like, yeah, these are hidden treasures.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask you a simple question.
Sure.
And I don't want to seem like I'm picking on Disney, because I love Disney. Disney of modern is not as prevalent. It's not as, you know, it's like when you have Tim Allen going in the Shaggy Dog, who else is going to sniff my butt? It's not as homespun as the classic Disney. And I don't mean just the cartoons, and I don't mean just the live action. I mean the action. I mean, Zorro would put a Z on somebody's tushy, but you'd never really see a lot of blood. You know what I mean? If somebody got shot, it was, and they fell down.
Right.
And today, it's like, there's violence for the sake of violence. What do you think
about
that?
Well, you're right. I mean, back in the day, of course, the degree of social need for pushing the envelope is pushing that whole, that whole issue of needing to be wowed one bit more. But, you know, back in the day, we called it being Disneyfied, and that was where you could entertain with story rather than with substance rather than, slapstick. And I'm sure there's exceptions, but you look at things like Mary Poppins and you look at The Swiss Family Robinson and some of those classic movies.
Pollyanna,
you bet. All those classic, and you can go back to The Love Bug and you can go to some of those movies that had, you know, where a Volkswagen had a personality. I mean, how, you know, there's where character development was truly, in my opinion, thought through and developed in a way that Walt Disney and what he demanded of his either actors, his animators, his writers, his studio execs, whatever. I think there was a degree that died when Walt died. And I, of course, worked at Disney from 78 to 84, and we saw there was really a slide downward without there wasn't even, I mean, obviously 74 or 78 was, 12 years after Walt's death. He died in 66. And there was just no leadership, no guidance. There was no one knew how to carry on. They wanted to keep Walt's ideas alive, but they also recognized that society was changing. And that was when, of course, Touchstone Pictures or Studios, which was Disney, was created so that Disney could create PG and beyond movies without the Disney label being tarnished by having extra violence or language or other issues. So, of course, Disney now owns several studios beyond Touchstone, and they're making a wide range of movies that oftentimes are not even associated with the Disney label whatsoever. But, I think, you know, it's a combination of both the leaders of Disney today, which is such a corporate giant, and the diversity of leadership within that corporation is trying to satisfy the greatest number of people, again, for the shareholders and the people that, you know, want to make Disney profitable and successful in that regard. It will never be what it was. There's no question. And whether society would accept a movie like Mary Poppins today, even though we accept it as a classic, whether or not a show like that would be successful, that's up for debate, of course, too.
Well, they're working on, and this will scare you, they're working on Mary Poppins Returns with Emily Blunt, playing Emily Blunt. Dick Van Dyke has a cameo. Angela Lansbury has a cameo. Oh, yeah. It's a big Disney production. And the kids are supposedly...
You know. Go ahead. Go ahead. If Disney had made Mary Poppins today, in whatever shape or form, it was just classic design for sequels. I mean, to have Mary come back to other families, to, you know, I mean, it would open the door for sequels because of the nature of the storyline itself. And I'm actually a little surprised it's taken this long for Disney. Of course, they don't like to touch their major, major classic movies a whole heck of a lot, but I think that's where we're headed.
Well, I have a problem with that because part of that problem, and I was reading about this, was P.L. Travers, as of course Walt said, Miss Travers, that ship has sailed. They made Mary Poppins, and that was it. And he approached her a couple of times more, and she, of course, said, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you. And I don't know how they got the rights, or what. I think it was a family member, since she's no longer, P.L. Travers is no longer with us. They gave the rights to do a per se sequel, and it is authorized by the estate. But, you know, I don't know how good or bad it's going to be. I don't know. Disney, and I love Disney. I love classic Disney. But Disney has tarnished itself for a long time.
Yeah, they've made a few bad movies. There's no question that definitely didn't equate to the quality nor the style of Disney. And I think that goes back to the discomfort of trying to emulate what Walt would have done with the people that were trying to do that. I just think it was a very difficult position for all involved in that.
So, I will tell you, I just watched the 20th anniversary of Splash. I'm dating myself. Oh my God. and that was, the DVD was 5 years, so we're talking the 25th anniversary of Splash. And watching a young Tom Hanks was a nobody then. Now,
yep.
You know, in this role, and this was something that you know, they were talking about it on the director commentary. Ron Howard and Brian Grazer and the writers were talking about how they went to the House of Mouse, and they were treated very, very well because they kept a lot of the Disneyfication in it. Even though it did have John Candy and it did have Eugene Levy, and Ron was new directing, and they knew that this was a wonderfully done film, and it was one of the few they think is a modern day Disney classic. Now, you of course keep up with the Disney, not rewards, the Disney, where Disney of course honors their own. And
right.
What do you did you see this year's list of who Disney is honoring this year?
Oh boy, I just noticed that they've got Carrie Fisher was gone, obviously, after her death here, of course. I did not see the complete list, so I cannot answer that with any degree of accuracy.
Well, Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher,
okay.
Oprah Winfrey, you know, Stan Lee from Marvel. I'm sorry, the grandfather of all comic books, you know, essentially,
mm-hmm.
is a Disney legend now because Marvel owns, they own Marvel.
Right.
So, you know, and I'm just surprised some of this, but, and I'm asking you, as for one, a writer, for two, as a Disney fan, do you think Princess Leia should be considered a Disney princess?
What
do you think? Before I forget, thank you, Diane, for the question.
Good question, Dan. Yeah, I think for today's generation, it fits. And what Disney is going to probably end up doing for the next 20 years with Star Wars, yes. And really, you have to go back and look at Disney in the historical context, and that is
there are very few characters that were really developed by Walt Disney. I mean, most of the characters, from Mary Poppins to the three little pigs to all these characters were developed by other people through cartoons or through actually through stories, and he brought them to life. So Princess Leia and Star Wars, again, are just other characters that were developed by, obviously, George Lucas, and developed into theme park rides, just like Snow White. Well, Snow White was a story, obviously written, long before the movie was ever made, and not by Walt Disney. And so would Snow White be any less of a princess than Princess Leia herself? I think it fits. It's just a more modern evolution of a princess development in the Disney caretaking of princesses and whatnot. But I guess that's my best answer, is that it doesn't feel like the same kind of princess. And you can, of course, look at Mulan, or you can look at the more recent, what was the most recent one? Moana.
Moana.
Yeah, and there's a more recent created character. I wouldn't call her a princess per se, but I think Princess Leia fits, because obviously her name is Princess Leia, or, she goes by that character name. And Disney owns, the rights to Star Wars. So from that perspective, I guarantee that the next 20 years and the next few movies and what Disney does with Star Wars Land, it will fit similarly to that which Snow White fit in Fantasyland, in my opinion. I say that with a little bit of pretense, but yeah.
Well, you know what I'm dating myself now. I used to miss every Sunday night at 7 o'clock. I don't care what we had to do. I had to be in front of the television every Sunday night at 7 o'clock for so many years,
Yep.
And they don't have shows like that anymore.
No,
you don't have an anthology show like that anymore.
Right.
Go ahead.
Variety and, the variety aspect, I mean, you can go back to even deeper, I'm dating myself, Paul Winchell at the Winchell Mahoney Time, which had two ventriloquist dummies that ran the show. I mean, you can go back to, that goes back
Edgar
to...
Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. Oh, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And so,
but what I loved about The Wonderful World of Color is you could watch Dr. Sin alias the Scarecrow with the late great Patrick McGoohan, or you could watch Guns in the Heather with Kurt Russell and Glenn Corbett, or you can even watch Disney had Betty Davis in of course the Return to Witch Mountain. Don't do good television like that anymore. And you don't get the per se name actors anymore. I mean, I was watching Miracle of the White Stallions. I'm dating myself now. James Franciscus, Kurt Jurgens, and it was talking about the Lipizzan Stallions. They don't do. Kids get bored with it rather than I was enamored of watching 2 hours, basically two episodes, of Wonderful World of Disney, where I learned about the Lipizzan Stallions, Almost Angels, where you learned about the Vienna Boys Choir. They don't want to devote television time to that. And it's not that I hate Lucifer, but, the TV show Lucifer is a ratings hit. And they had their own with the Devil and Max Devlin in 78, so it's not like They've done this before.
Well,
even though they made Bill Cosby a devil.
absolutely. I think you answered your question, though, because you said they don't make television like they used to, as the quality. And you also said that today's watching audience, the youth and the teens, they don't have the ability to stay focused long enough to absorb the quality of some aspect of a show that was actually not just entertaining, but had a story, had a character, had an education component. The aspect of society today, the larger aspect is has a shorter attention span, and the producers of various programs who do many studies to see what works and what doesn't is creating the television shows we see today. And I think the shows of yesteryear, of our era, have certainly gone by the way of the dodo, and we will see what I would hope someday, maybe an evolution back into something of substance. I don't know. And certainly writing books is one of those things that sort of suffers from that same calamity, and that is getting somebody to sit down and read long enough to get into the character, to get into the story and the plot, and to be enveloped imaginatively into the story. That's something as a writer is hard, because we are dealing with an audience that you have to grasp them sooner than later. Otherwise, you will lose them.
Okay, you have 5 hidden Mickey books. Am I correct, or is there more?
There are 5. The first 2 were written by both Nancy and myself. After we ended number 1, we when we got together for the first time, after we wrote the first one, we had, of course, the end of the first one, which has that kind of, I won't call it a jaw-dropping ending, but it has an ending that a lot of people didn't see coming. And we knew, and I wrote within 10 minutes, we were doing a book signing at a Barnes & Noble. We had just gotten done, and I had my laptop with me, and I wrote 4 pages of what I considered the end of book 2. And I handed that to Nancy, and she started crying. And, of course, we're both fairly emotional Disney fans, but I wanted to really hit on this end of book 2 to be the emotional ending of the 2 books. And so when we ended book 1, we knew right where we were going to end book 2, because I had written that 4-page ending. And so then we just created a diverse storyline from the first book that led one of the characters, Lance, from the first book, to create his, he became more of a hero in book 2, where he was sort of I don't want to give it away, but he was kind of the antagonist at the end of book 1. So it was an interesting dilemma we wanted to, because everyone loved Lance in book 1. So we really wanted to give him a way out to be the hero rather than the goat, and it really came off nicely. And so books 1 and 2 are sort of bookends. Nancy wanted to write a fantasy take of time travel through a portal at Disneyland using one of the characters we introduced in book 2. And so she wrote books 3 and 4, which the first one was The Legend of Tom Sawyer Island, and the third one was, I'm drawing a blank on her book. And then while she was writing book 4, I was writing book 5, which was Chasing New Frontiers, which was based on a true story that I had read in David Koenig's book, Reality Land, about a guy who worked at Disneyland many years ago, and he stole a lot of money, and he hid the money in Disneyland to get it out later, and he died, and no one knows where he hid the money. It was, according to legend, it's still hidden to this day. And I thought that was just an amazing, perfect fit for a new hidden Mickey book, standalone book. So I wrote book 5 with new characters and this story of a guy who worked at the park and ended up stealing money, hiding it somewhere secret, and of course passing away before he could get it out of the park. And 40 years later, 2 people, the main characters of the book, of course, stumble upon a clue to that long lost stolen money, and so that created Hidden Mickey 5. So there are 5 books in that series. Of course, I did write, right after that, I did write the book In the Shadow of the Matterhorn, which is a nonfiction book about my years growing up I grew up a mile from Disneyland and how that affected us growing up. And of course, my 6 years working in the park. And I always wanted to delve into some of the never before published stories about what I had experienced at the park and some of the insider stories. And I, in the cover of the book, I say it's the book is in the Shadow of the Matterhorn, and it's Love, Laughter, and Life at Disneyland. And it was really a fun book to recollect the years growing up, because I can remember growing up riding my bike to kindergarten and seeing the Matterhorn just down the street. And you can imagine a 6-year-old seeing this snow-capped mountain.
Oh, I remember when I saw it, and I was not a 6-year-old. I know. It's magic.
Yeah,
but I have a young lady named Beth. She's not your Beth, trust me. Her name is Beth Jane, and she said to me, she says, "I love the Hidden Mickeys. When is he writing a book 6?
We get that all the time. I will tell Beth and all of our listeners out there, I do have the outline to a book 6. It is a slightly darker tale about a kidnapping at Disneyland. And it's an interesting, more modern approach to Disney. And similar to book 5, there's a love story. There's a love story in each of the books, of course. 1, 2, 1 and 2 and 5 have a distinctive love story, as well as Dancing 3 and 4. And there is a potential for a book 6, or maybe I'll title it something totally different, because I think Nancy and I feel like the Hidden Mickey. Now, I will plug Nancy's other book. She has the Hidden Mickey Adventures, which are preteen tales for the preteen readers about actually the son and daughter of the two main characters from book 2. That would be Lance
Beth.
No, that was the first book. I'm blanking out on our main character, Lance, and I want to say Jennifer. And so the their kids become sort of Disney sleuths, and she's got 3 books, I believe, out now. One that centers on the Haunted Mansion, one that centers on, I think, Tom Sawyer Island, and one other one. So they're fun little stories, a little bit shorter. Books about younger characters and their, I would say, more like a Hardy Boy, Nancy Drew kind of characterization.
Well, let me ask you this: would you venture? You said you have it in outline. When do you think it would be out in a book? Because people have just asked me. Yeah. Not that I don't love Nancy. You could write with her. I'm not trying to be pushy, but
no,
I would love you to write with her. I mean, everybody's saying lovely things.
Well, we had a great relationship.
I've gotten 6 of your fans here that are messaging me on Facebook.
Well, let me say that we had a wonderful, wonderful time writing, obviously, the first 2 books. I think distance and the fact that her writing style, she loves a more fantasy-based writing style. And we just decided to kind of go in 2 different directions with, obviously, the Hidden Mickey books. And I'm not ruling out that we would never write again together. I think it was a really good chemistry. Nancy's a very good writer, and she created some wonderful characters, and I think it was a great marriage of writing styles that blended well. I think it would, and it allowed us to also, one thing that I think both our 2 books by ourselves lacked was the detail of editing, that we both edited each other when we wrote books 1 and 2, and both 3, 4, and 5, obviously, we did on our own, and we did our own editing with our own editors. So it lacked that part of the chemistry that we had with books 1 and 2. So books 1 and 2 were just a blast to write, and ironically, a lot of people come to us and they say, you know, book 1 especially has such a unique feel. A lot of people feel like they're watching a movie. which is always a great compliment when they feel like when somebody's reading a book and they feel like they're seeing it in their mind's eye. And I think part of that was due to the fact that we wrote the book together without actually having not seen each other during the entire writing process. And it was all done through either phone calls or emails. And so there was a certain development through the writing process that created that I think was unique. And I think that comes through a little bit in, especially in book one, when we were able to share each other's work, and then I would edit or change or add to what she had written, and she would do the same. And so that was really a fun way to put that book together. And book two was done the same way. In fact, book two was done a little bit more where I would write an entire two or three chapters and she would write an entire two or three chapters. And so there's a little bit more distinctive writing style in certain chapters, which is interesting in book two, that we did not have in book one, where there was more collaboration through each chapter rather than one of us writing one chapter each, which is really interesting to do.
Betty had a question here for you. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm a publisher. I own Synergy Books Publishing. I represent many authors, including top-selling authors such as Kristen Decker's 50 Years in Polygamy, Spencer Anderson's amazing two books, The Last Raider and Avenging Angel, which are two Clive Cussler kind of books, very well written. I also represent some Disney authors. One of them is Lynn Woodward and Ken Pullman, who wrote Cleaning the Kingdom. They were both sweepers at Disneyland, and they had stories about their years working there. And Russ Flores' book, Seen Unseen Disney, which are a visual book of things that you see but never notice at Disneyland. And those are all very, very good selling books. So right now I'm more in the publishing realm than writing. In the process, like I said, I'm actually building a new house, so we are in the throes of, we just moved out of our large home, and we're in a small home to kind of get us through until our new home is done. So I am not writing anything as we speak until we get settled in. Now, the nice thing about getting settled in is to a nice rhythm and routine. When I speak to writers groups and writers in general, there's many different ways to write, but one of the ways to write successfully is to have a set time that you can set aside, that you can devote to writing. And I think that's an important aspect to any good writing, is to have that time expected as set aside. Otherwise, you have so many things that get in the way of your writing that you'll never get it done, unfortunately, for many authors.
Well, let me ask a simple question, because we have 5 minutes of the hour here.
You bet.
Wanted to know, how do these people get a hold of you that want to drop you a line or ask you a question or whatever?
Well, they can always go to synergy-books.com, and my website is there. My contact information is there. I have several email addresses. The one that I use most is acrprez, A as in Apple, C as in Car, R as in Richard, Prez like President, P-R-E-S, the number one, at msn.com, or you can find me on Facebook. I'm on Facebook quite a bit. Can Google me and just Google Dave Smith Disney. Of course, there's the other Dave Smith. You make sure you can Google Dave Smith.
Let's clarify this for 1 second. This is not the Ask Dave Smith of D23. No, this is not.
Right.
I want to make sure. Even though he's a lovely man.
Yeah, Dave and I worked together at Disneyland in the same era, so a lot of people with two Dave Smiths working at Disneyland at the same time was interesting. In fact, Dave had come up to us at a Disneyana convention and actually told us, said he loved our books and had read them, came up to Nancy and myself, and that's a great compliment coming from him, who has written so many marvelous. Dave Smith, the archivist, that would be him. I am Dave Smith, the former ride operator operations. at Disney, and I'm not as big of a name as Mr. He's a wonderful, wonderful man.
Well, believe me, I've already had three people say, is he the one that does the Ask Dave column? No.
Not the same one, but I think you can pretty much, I know a lot about Disney, inner workings of Disney, although he knows a whole lot more than I do, but I did work in attractions and did a lot of things. I drove the monorail for a year. I worked West Side Operations, Haunted Mansion, Canoes, Keelboats, Pirates of the Caribbean. And so anybody who has a question about working at Disneyland and some of the amazing things that we experienced, was you're always welcome to drop me a line, and I'll be happy to answer those questions.
And I want you to mention your tennis books and everything else. What is the newest one you have?
The newest book I've written is In the Shadow
of
Matterhorn. I wrote that last, and I wrote that right after Hidden Mickey 5. My two tennis books, they're the two of the top five selling books. Tennis Mastery. My father was national runner-up coach of the year. Back in the 80s, he and I had the most successful tennis team in the country for 22 years at the high school level. And so I wanted to document, he died unexpectedly at the age of 55. I wanted to capture his legacy as well as my own teaching in two books. One is called Tennis Mastery, and the other one is called Coaching Mastery. And I was senior editor for TennisOne.com and written about 300 articles on tennis as well. And I've really enjoyed my profession in tennis as well as in the writing profession. But you can get those at Barnes & Noble. You can get all of our books at Barnes & Noble, Amazon. Virtually any bookstore carries all of them. So if they don't have them, they can get them. But you can always drop me a line, and we'll send you an autographed copy as well.
Don't tempt me. I have a hidden Mickey I'd love you to autograph.
Well, I would love to do that, Bennett. That would be my pleasure.
Haven't bought Hidden Mickey 1, it's not just a YA book. I was an adult. I read it. I was fascinated. This man and Nancy both wrote a book that is not just a YA book. It's not a children's book.
No, it
is
fascinating. It was written for children. It was written for the adult reader, although kids have loved it. I've had adults tell me their 10-year-old, 12-year-olds read it, and so we wrote it for the adult reader. It's a high-level read, but it has been enjoyed by all ages. So that's been a great plus as well.
I will say this. This man's been on my wish list as guests, and I hate to scratch his name off because I want him to come back.
Anytime, Bennett. It's been a pleasure, obviously, chatting with you and reminiscing with you as well.
Now, this is from Brett, and Brett asks, do you have a favorite Disney movie? Hey, these aren't my questions. This is from the audience, so yeah.
Well, my favorite movie, ironically, you asked about a movie, because the movie National Treasure inspired me to write Hidden Mickey, because after seeing that and reading the book Da Vinci Code, I loved it. Just really hit the nail on the head. My favorite Disney movie, you know, when Splash came out.
Hey, National Treasure will do. I love National Treasure, and it's a Disney movie.
And Jerry Bruckheimer asked us for our book, so we would love for Jerry to do a screenplay, and one of the screenplay writers, Todd Simovich, contacted us and mentioned that there was some interest there, and we would love, because I think it would make a fascinating movie about Walt leaving clues and the characters develop through that process of following those clues and learning about Disney and ultimately finding what is at the end of that trail. But,
the question is, do you think Disney would make it?
We would love it if Disney made it because, part of the Hidden Mickey books all take place at Disneyland. So obviously that would be difficult for a non-Disney producer to do it. I think Jerry Bruckheimer would be an ideal producer, since he already has a very close working relationship with Disney, with the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and others. And I just feel that even though the books take you in many, many locations outside of Disney, there are many times they go back into the park to follow a clue or figure out a clue. And we just feel that it would be so fun to, for people to see it from that perspective of seeing things that they know. I think people would love to go back to Disneyland and go, hey, that's right where that scene in the movie was, took place, and that kind of thing. And always a blast.
Dave, thank you very, very much. Have a good evening. Have a good week, and have a good holiday.
And you too, Bennett, and thank all your listeners for taking the time to chime in here, and look forward to maybe doing it again with you soon.
Thank you, sir. Have a good night.
Good night.